You gotta die, gotta die, gotta die for your government! Die for your country, that shit! You gotta die, gotta die, gotta die for your government! Die for your country, that shit!
This is Comics Therapy, episode 61. No reviews, just analysis. I'm Aaron Myers, and my co-host, as always, is Andrea Shockling. Up this week, two comics from October 1st, 2014, Bucky Barnes, The Winter Soldier, number 1, and Grayson, number 3. In between segments, listen to another Second Opinion, and on the couch, we welcome artist Annie Wu. Just as a reminder, we never do reviews, but we do talk a lot, so there may be spoilers ahead. And obviously, you've probably noticed I'm sick, so if you can't stand the sound of my voice, skip ahead to the interview.
They can skip around and just listen to me.
Yeah, I mean, if somebody emails us, I could probably just send them the audio of just your side.
That would be fine.
Yeah.
Hi, guys. This is Carl Smith, and I'm calling in with my second opinion. I got into comic books like many people my age did, and that's off of spinner racks at gas stations and drugstores. You were sort of trapped into reading what they carried, and for that reason, I became a Make Mine Marvel guy. The quick shop that was near my house primarily carried Marvel comic books, and since there was no internet and we didn't have access to things like previews and I didn't have a comic book store or any older readers that were there to inform me, it was a very singular and very personal endeavor. I'd pick up a comic book, I'd read it, I would like it or I wouldn't, but since I spent my 75 cents on it, I would probably like it no matter what. And then I would read it over and over and over and over again until the cover fell off. And my only exposure to other comic books would either be swapping with friends, borrowing from other friends, or through the ads that were within the comic books themselves. So comic books for me weren't really an entirely social event as much as they were kind of a journey of luck and self-discovery.
Welcome to Comics Therapy. Neither Aaron nor I are licensed therapists, so don't take anything we say seriously. This week, while Aaron is in the throes of yet another illness, we're looking at antiheroes, but cut from a very specific cloth. Say you're a former sidekick. You used to pal around with, like, pretty serious hero types, Captain America, say, or, I don't know, fucking Batman. Strong moral integrity. Clear-cut sense of right and wrong. Willing to go to extremes to help the little guy. So what happens when you stop being that sidekick? When you get to decide the hero that you want to be instead of standing in the shadows of another, what traits would you emulate? How much of your former role model would you use to define yourself? We're looking at two books this week whose characters are definitely not sidekicks and haven't been for a while. These men have broken away from their former identities, though those experiences still inform the kind of hero they are today. The Assassin and the Spy.
And the Podcaster, in your case.
As a hero?
Well, as an anti-hero and a sidekick, a current sidekick, but someday maybe a former sidekick.
I like to read my comic books in print. I have nothing against digital. I think it's an amazing technology. I think it levels the playing field for artists and creators. And I think it definitely removes some of the hurdles to get your ideas out into the market. But I like a print comic book. I like the way they smell. I like the way they look. I like the way they're presented. I think it's neat to have something that you can pull out and remind yourself of what was going on 30 years ago. The covers become iconic. The ads become almost as iconic. And it's just a little time capsule that just reminds you that this happened at a particular period of time and needs to be considered that way. I would think that a trade paperback of something like Atari Force would not be as valuable to me because it kind of seems silly out of context. But when you open it up and see the ads for what kids were into and what was going on in the world and what TV shows were on, it puts it all into place and you realize that you have to consider these things, these works of art, within the context they were created. And I will always love a loose issue of comic book over a collected trade paperback.
Each episode in between comic segments, you'll hear one listener answering a series of questions, sharing his or her favorite comics, creators, and more. We call it a second opinion. And this week's is brought to you by Carl Smith. If you don't know already, Carl is in the midst of a Kickstarter campaign for his most ages horror anthology, The Horror of Loon Lake. If you want to leave your own response for us to use on a future show, the prompts are on the website, comicstherapy.com. The link to Carl's Kickstarter is there also. You can always call, Skype, or email your MP3 to us. Remember, read comics responsibly, kids, and always get a second opinion.
In between shows, you can find me on Twitter, at Aaron Myers, and Andrea, at Andrea Schock. The show account is at Comics Therapy. Hello.
How you doing, Myers?
Not well, thank you for asking.
Okay, so this is week 2 or 3 of your sickness. You had like a weird reprieve for Rose City, and then you like are fucking dead again.
Well, yep. It's kids. These kids, man. Getting sick all the time.
So you're just blaming the kids.
Well, it was Luke who gets sick at preschool and then brings it home, and then I get sick.
Hmm.
It's not really blame if you can trace the source of the infection.
What's the plan? How are you going to get through these dire times?
I don't know. This is awful. This is why fathers leave.
That is almost the worst thing that you've ever said.
Yeah. Well, I'm sick. I could do better when I'm well.
But, I mean, for real, we've got, like, 2 seasons in comics therapy world. One where Aaron's sick all fucking fall and winter and early spring, and then the other where, thank goodness, you're not.
Yeah. People think it's a joke how, like, much I say, oh, I hate being sick. No, stay away from me, germs. But I get sick so easy, and I get sick so often once cold and flu season comes around. It's ridiculous.
And you get sick so hard.
Yeah, like, I'm down for a
week. You don't get a little cold. Like or you're just a big baby. I mean, no. I don't want to make any judgments.
I am not. This is taking every ounce of energy I have to sit and talk to you. Like, more so than usual.
Right. For the people, Aaron Myers.
I'm trying. I'm trying to do what I can.
It was
a weird comics week regardless.
Why?
Because X-Force number 2 actually became worth money.
Oh, right. That was hilarious.
Yep, it is. X-Force, people were buying X-Force number 1 and X-Force number 2 for between $10 and $50.
And that's not going to be around for very long, right? Like, that's a short-lived windfall.
Yeah, it's already, because there's so many of that comic printed. That's why it's funny, because if you are not a comics reading child of the 90s, you probably don't realize why there's 50 copies of X-Force number 1 and 2 in every comic shop, because it was one of the most heavily printed comics of the 90s. And it has these huge print runs, and it's like shops couldn't give it away.
It was like 1 million copies or something, right?
X-Force number 2 has like 1 million copies printed. X-Force number 1 was 1.5 million. It's gigantic.
Mm-hmm.
So overprinted.
I personally gave you like at least 3 copies of that book.
For sure.
Right.
And I think I gave them away after I sorted through everything.
Mm-hmm.
Because who wants that until now? So whatever, it's a weird comic speculator world, and it's all around the Deadpool movie, which I'm not particularly excited for.
I know, especially considering you're not really a huge Deadpool fan.
No, not at all. Like, I have no attachment to that comic whatsoever.
Right.
But whatever. It's fine to resell it. I bought a bunch of other comics. I sold a bunch of copies. Bought a bunch of comics I wanted. So the cycle of comics life continues.
Anything else?
I'm really sick.
Okay. That's going to be the theme for the week. And that's fine. I'm leaving for Pittsburgh tomorrow. And from there, I'm going straight to New York. So I'm like 100% focused on that. I'm sorry that you're sick. And I'm happy for you and your little Deadpool X-Force extravaganza.
Thank you.
But I don't care, because I'm pretty much 100% thinking about all of the shit that I have to do in the next 24 hours. Less so now, in the next, let's call it 18 hours before I go to the airport.
Oh, well, you better have some good stuff to say about our comics then.
I do.
Okay. Well, I mean, you're not phoning it in, because I don't know if you know this. I'm sick and I'm sitting down to do a podcast with you.
You are a hero, like we're talking about, the kind that we're talking about, the assassin spy kind.
Sure. I mean, yeah.
Yeah.
I can't disagree with that.
Yeah. It's cool. You want to talk about them? That was nice little punctuation with the cough. It's kind of a pathetic cough, not going
to
lie.
Well, I can do better later, but nobody wants to pay for that.
It won't surprise many of you to hear that my favorite series is Skull Kickers. What Jim Zub and Ed Hwang and Misty Coates have done over there at Skull Kickers is just nothing short of amazing for me. It's not very often that you see a comic book that really just gets you and provides everything that you want out of a comic book, yet completely surprises you at every turn. And for me, Skull Kickers is that book. It's a fantasy book about a barbarian that wields a sort of magical pistol and a dwarf that doesn't really do anything that's really redeeming. And the two of them sort of had this weird bromance where they really don't necessarily have any reason to be together. And they sort of always just fall ass backwards into adventures and just, you know, muck things up enough for the bad guys that they kind of look like heroes. It's a wonderful, funny fantasy tale. Never takes itself too serious. It throws a lot of fantasy conventions out the window. It's just a wonder to read. And everything about it is just perfect, from the way it looks to how it's written to all the characterizations to the sound effects. Everything is just super. I'm very proud to say that the readership has supported it enough to allow it to continue through its intended arcs. It is coming to an end, but it's ending where the team kind of visioned it to end. And so that in itself is a victory, although it just tears me up inside to think this time next year that there will be no more Skull Kickers on the horizon. So that's my favorite.
Our first book this week is Bucky Barnes, The Winter Soldier, number one, as written by Ailes Cott. Is that right?
Ailes. With a SH sound?
Ailes.
Try again. Ailes. Do you hear the difference in what you're saying and what I'm saying?
I can't hear a damn thing right now.
Okay, keep going.
And the art is by Marco Rudy. Clayton Coles did the lettering and production. Bucky is published by Marvel Comics.
Everybody knows James Buchanan Barnes was Captain America's sidekick during World War II. Then he was the Winter Soldier, brainwashed Russian assassin. Then he was actually Captain America for a bit, and now he's the man on the wall, protecting Earth from all manner of threats in a role he inherited from Nick Fury. This is another first issue. Generally, Aaron whines about doing first issues. As you've heard, he's exceptionally whiny this week for other reasons. That means I got to make all of the decisions. That's why we're talking about this book, because I'm a sucker for themes.
Fine. And you also said you had some very interesting things to talk about. So I would like to be interested in what you have to say.
No pressure.
Right.
So I actually think it's sort of interesting when you look at a character that has been a sidekick and then on his or her own, when they have the chance to interact with like a younger subordinate character, like Daisy in this case.
Okay.
I think Bucky and Daisy's relationship is really interesting, and I hope that that continues. Like, I'm glad to see that she's in this, and I hope that that continues. But I think that their interactions, sort of decidedly not painting her as a sidekick, and the very candid conversations they have about what it means to be partners, and what it means to be, like, truly having each other's back and kind of sharing the load, in not a subordinate way, I think is cool. That is a growth in Bucky's case that I think it makes it an interesting dynamic.
Sure. I see this as, it's the sitcom syndrome though, right?
Okay.
Because without making her the sidekick specifically, you have her as the romantic interest throughout the story.
Is that an overt romantic interest?
No, but that's why that's why it's the sitcom syndrome. It's the will they, won't they kind of thing.
Okay, I understand what
you mean. You know, whereas if she was his sidekick, then that sets up more of the, there's more of the authority structure, and it makes the sexual tension far different.
Yeah, absolutely. That is a really important point, especially in, well, there's an age difference too, which complicates things, but it's also like comic book age difference.
Right. So. I mean, Bucky is 95 years old.
Right. You know? Right.
So.
So awkward. Right.
But he looks good.
Gold digger.
Uh-huh. She likes Russian men.
Whatever.
So I think that's a fine dynamic that propels a story. It's, you know, there's a reason it's in so many stories, but it's far different than, you know, Captain America and Bucky, I hope. Right?
Yeah, absolutely. Because that relationship wasn't trying to be anything other than sidekick. I mean, talk about age difference. Like in the originals, where he's like a kid. Yeah. He's a teenager.
Right. No, it is.
I'm a much bigger fan of the version that everyone is familiar with in the movie. I just like that balance.
Oh, yeah, better. For sure. Especially in the movie, the only reason Bucky is the sidekick is because he doesn't have the super soldier serum. I mean, right. prior to Steve becoming Captain America, Bucky is really, like, Steve is more Bucky's sidekick.
Right, and I just think that is a really, that's a cool dynamic that works in the way that the character's been sort of revamped for the movies.
Yeah, I mean, it's a more realistic interaction.
Sure. But in this book, Bucky doesn't have, I mean, the Winter Soldier as a character doesn't have much of those sidekick trappings left anymore. It's been too long, and he's been on his own for so long that it's almost like, I mean, he truly is talking about a different man at that point.
Oh, sure.
So I think then in his case, articulating that he's not interested in perpetuating that kind of sidekick relationship is what is so intriguing.
See, what
like,
I find
he doesn't want to recreate that.
See, what I find intriguing about these stories, and when it comes to the sidekicks then stepping out on their own, I mean, really, if you're both of these books that we're looking at, they're not characters stepping out on their own. They're filling shoes. So, like, Bucky is filling the shoes of Nick Fury. He's taking over that role. None of this is unique. It's all of these stories are about perpetuating legends in that way. You know, like Thor this week, you know, there will always be a Thor. You know, there will always be a Nick Fury, even if his name isn't Nick Fury. There'll always be the Watcher on the Wall in that regard. Mm-hmm. You know, there's always going to be a Captain America, whether it's Steve Rogers or not. That's part of what I kind of love about comics, is that there are these allegories for needs of humanity and the avatars that kind of fill them for whatever time that is.
Mm-hmm.
So that's kind of what I see a lot in this series taking place, too.
Is the coming into a different kind of iconic hero role, but one that is still always there.
Yeah, I mean, the individual who fills the shoes could have his own personality, but the job remains the same.
Is there always a role then for, like, that anti-hero assassin, like, working for the greater good but willing to do almost anything kind of guy?
Yeah, it's Wolverine until they're killing him. He's the best at what he does.
Is it really actually Wolverine? Because I don't know. Wolverine is sort of in a separate...
No, I'd say Wolverine, Nick Fury are those guys. They're the guys who do the dirty work.
Is that what an anti-hero is then?
In terms of Marvel, I guess, yeah. I would say that.
Yeah.
Sure.
Yeah.
It's and in a lot of ways, like in Avengers too, where you have like the Illuminati who are in that role. They are anti-heroes.
Are they anti-heroes?
Yeah, because they were willing to do what had to be done, knowing that the rest of the heroes would never go along with it because they were doing non-heroic acts for the sake of humanity. So, I mean, that's an anti-hero to me. And it's all these debatable things, you know, and even we're getting off this particular book, but in Avengers, it gets to that point where they decide this is the line, you know, if we cross it, we no longer have any kind of standing as heroes.
So does that mean that anybody who sort of associates with that character type is also buying into that philosophy? And I guess I'm thinking then about Daisy, who I've always sort of liked, although I don't know a ton about her character. Every time she pops up, I'm like, but I feel like in this dynamic between Daisy and Bucky, there's a chance for her personality to be influenced, but not in a, man, I have to be careful about the way that I say that, because it's just sort of reaffirming that dominant subordinate relationship that I agree with you. They're trying really hard not to, to emphasize. But I do think that, like, Bucky's lone wolf strategies and sort of personality type and, like, the kind of fuck all way that he goes about doing things could have some influence on Daisy, even though they're working more like partners, not like sidekick and hero.
Yeah.
So does Daisy come out at the end of this as an anti-hero herself?
Or she doesn't come out of it at all. Sometimes in the end, the collateral damage is those that are around the main character.
Oh, so we're just going to kill her off?
It happens a lot. Mm. The sidekick of the sidekick is usually the red shirt.
But he's not a sidekick anymore. Like, can you never escape from that?
Well, there's always...
Once a sidekick, always a sidekick?
Well, there's always there's a legacy there. And I think it's even further exemplified in our next book.
Hmm. Okay.
That's code for my lungs are on fire and we need to keep going.
So that you can cough and nobody has to listen and then we'll just edit it
Correct.
Out? Awesome.
All right.
Where Skullkicker sort of throws everything that makes high concept fantasy what it is, Mice Templar sort of embraces all those things and delivers a wonderfully familiar but really rich, high fantasy world. Mice Templar is so filled with mythologies and legends and histories and factions. There's beautiful maps of places that they don't even go in the story yet, and creatures of all sorts, and there's gods that serve over the good and the bad. There's legends, there's alternate worlds, there's people turning on each other and people helping each other in secret and motives and everything that just makes this sort of fantasy story work. I really love it. It's really got a epic, if I can use that word correctly, scope. If you were just to read the first hardcover, it'd be a wonderful story. And you'd say that was a fantastic fantasy story that ends at a natural place. There's room for more, but it was completely satisfying. And then Glass and Oming just went from there and have developed this incredible world. Glass doing most of the heavy lifting here with his wonderful writing. And I'll be honest to admit that I kind of side on the fandom level of writers, and Glass is definitely one that I really would like to emulate as far as how great of a job he does fleshing out his characters and giving you a world that feels like it's lived in. Mice Templar, unfortunately, doesn't get a lot of attention publicly, which is a shame because it is a fully realized fantasy realm and one that you could really wiggle about in for a long time and not get bored.
Our second book this week is Grayson number 3. It's plotted by Tim Seeley and Tom King, with the script itself written by Tom King. Mike Janin did the art, Jeremy Cox did the coloring, and Carlos M. Mangual did the lettering. Grayson is published by DC Comics.
Dick Grayson was an acrobat in the circus, then he was Robin, Batman's sidekick, then he was Nightwing, solo hero, and now he's Agent 37, a spy working for Spiral.
Ta-da.
Da-da-da-da-da, da-da-da-da-da.
But he will always be Batman's sidekick.
Well, he certainly has a much more, like, report back to authority kind of thing going on in this book. And the lines of communication are more directly open back to Batman than certainly with Bucky and anybody that he used to report back to.
Yeah.
But continue what you were saying about legacy. Because I think that you're right. It's important. And a lot of that has to do with the amount of time that Dick Grayson spent in the traditional sidekick role before going out on his own versus, like, our modern conception of Bucky is mostly after he was out of that sidekick role.
Yeah, I guess so. I guess.
Like, anti-hero comes more naturally to Bucky, I think, than it does to Dick.
Yeah, and I'd say it also comes more naturally to the Marvel Universe than it does to the DC Universe for some reason.
Mm. Okay.
Maybe that's just my perception, but I definitely don't feel like DC Comics lend themselves to that style for some reason. It's hard for me to explain why.
Yeah, I would like to hear why you think that, because...
I think that goes back to that perception.
I, of course, have less information, but...
Yeah, it goes back to just that feeling of what a DC Comics universe should be like and what a Marvel universe should be like. Mm-hmm. Just from, I guess, from early reading. But DC definitely has more of that legacy of black and white, I guess, you know? Okay. Rather than kind of the gray areas with Marvel that I've always felt was there, like... This might not be the right thing, but it's somewhat the right thing, and the consequences mm-hmm. of that we'll have to live with. Like, there's a lot of that, I'd say, in Batman, but ultimately, Batman gets over things pretty fast, you know? Like bad stuff happens, Robins die, and then
he bounces back. He's fine.
Right, he moves on. Like, I don't feel like that kind of stuff sticks so much in DC just because it's not the legacy of DC, and that's all I could really say about it. Maybe in a more clear mind state, I'd be able to articulate it better.
Is this, though, more of a like change that is sticking? It seems like it.
I guess so. I mean, sure, they're for various reasons, because, you know, Nightwing and who he is was publicly broadcast. He can no longer kind of hide behind a persona. So it's a matter then of becoming a deep cover secret agent.
Why? Why can't he hide behind a different persona? Why go from a public hero to the shadows, which is like inherently, like spies are a very high example on the list of definitions of what it means to be an anti-hero. Like, you're totally working for the greater good. Yeah, we bet you are. We just don't have any fucking clue what you're doing because you're all sneaky about right. it.
Or, obviously, you know, the agents don't always know if what they're doing is for the greater good.
Right.
Because they're more tools, like precise instruments to be, you know, used in a mission. Whether that mission is for a good cause or a bad cause is, I mean, often in a lot of spy novels, you find out maybe it wasn't. I mean, like a James Bond or something like that, typically, it was for Queen and Country and to save the Earth, which I think mm-hmm. This series seems to draw a lot of inspiration from. But
in terms of, you know, greater good stuff?
Greater good and stylistic and, you know, it's sort of the whole ladies man, you know, undercover agent gallivanting around the world doing spy stuff. I mean, that's very Bondy.
Okay.
In my mind.
Sure, sure. He's certainly, in this issue especially, was one particular lady was all up in his business.
Sure.
She happens to be a fellow agent and also, well, we won't go further than that. But I don't know. I just feel like this legacy that you're talking about with his character, like, I don't know enough about Dick Grayson and about the transition from Nightwing to spy to buy into it as the only option. But that is almost entirely likely my bias based on ignorance.
Sure. Okay. Well, let's take it back a step. So in terms of Batman and his sidekicks and those mm-hmm. who break away from him, I don't think it ever... I think the only way to break away from Batman and being part of the Bat family, which is almost like a cult in itself, the only escape is death. And that doesn't always stick either. That's only half the time.
But it's obviously not... It doesn't stick if it's a fake death, because he's still reporting back
to him. Well, that's what I mean. So he's changed his life. He's become this secret agent guy. You know, that's for a time. He'll be back. You always come back to the family. And I think that's more the analysis of what Batman and the Batman legacy means, you know, in this world, than Dick Grayson himself and this particular storyline.
So he's still a sidekick.
Yeah.
He's just on a much longer leash.
It is the illusion of autonomy.
Wow. Okay.
But I think that's true for a lot. You know, these are two examples, but I think there's a lot of examples in the superhero universe and, you know, literature and whatever, where it goes back to that legacy and filling shoes. You know, the tether is always there.
Yeah. I mean, I think that the notion of what it means to be a sidekick is something that, like, I want to talk more about. When we were preparing for this week, I was talking with Roderick Ruth okay. about the other series, Sidekick, the actual series that is entitled Sidekick. And I think the eighth issue comes out at the end of this month. And so I'm actually really interested in talking about what that means. Not that I want to like lock us into necessarily discussing that series, but potentially I do. Because the notion that you can never escape that subordinate role is one that I think I agree with you in terms of what Dick Grayson is doing. But I think it's more compelling that he's doing a different kind of work.
Sure.
And like that's the same thing with, I guess, sort of with Daisy, is that it's a different... Ultimately, this is me not quite backpedaling, but definitely like giving you some context for why it was more interesting to me to focus on the anti-hero stuff this week than the legacy of being a sidekick. Because I think that both of them, both Dick and Bucky, or I did think until you fucking reminded me that Dick's situation is a little bit more complicated, I didn't feel like they were sidekicks anymore. But like, you're basically saying, yeah, Dick Grayson is still totally Batman's like guy on the inside.
Sorry to tell you how it is.
Well, I guess props to you that you can even do that when you're this deathly ill.
The only thing, that's the last thing to go, is me showing you how you're wrong or how you're missing something.
Right.
That's the final stage.
I get so much practice with that, but it's good to know that that's something that I don't have to give up soon.
I will always be your anti-self-esteem sidekick.
That is the worst thing that you've ever said.
There we go. We found it. I'm feeling better.
No, I want to think more about this. And again, obviously, my kind of big picture mastery of the, like, what it means to have been Robin and Nightwing and, like, all of that fucking baggage is cursory at best.
Mm-hmm.
But I need to think a little bit more about that, like, empowerment or lack thereof, the difference between what Dick is doing and what Bucky is doing. And, man, Dick is much more like a part of the system. And therefore, sorry, kiddo, maybe you're not quite the anti-hero that I thought you could be.
It's all right. In the end, you know, we find out things about ourselves we didn't want to find
like
out.
Like you're sick.
Yep. Did I mention that?
And I'm, yeah, I think you did. And I'm going to New York next week.
Great. Well, we've covered everything.
Yep.
And we sort of made it through.
I'm fine.
Yeah, I'm not.
We talked about comics, so I think that means that we can be finished.
Sure. I think everyone should listen to our interview with Annie Wu.
Hell yes.
Because I was not sick
Annie
at that time.
Annie Wu is awesome. No, you were not sick. She is delightful and fucking hilarious. And absolutely everybody should listen to our interview with Annie Wu. Previously recorded, so you don't have to deal with Myers coughing or sniffing or snotting on the internet.
For now. Until next week, at least.
I tried for over a half hour to record this last bit where I would promote my own book, The Darkness Out of Carthage, which is available on Amazon and Kindle, but I can't do it. I am not very good at self-promotion, and I felt awkward and disingenuous and intrusive. So instead, I'd like to close out my second opinion by saying Legend Comics and Coffee is truly the most amazing place on the planet. If anyone has an LCS that they love as much as I love Legend, you're a lucky person. It is a perfect place at the perfect time with the perfect staff. And winning the Eisner this year probably validates all their efforts for customer service and just being decent human beings. But it doesn't even come close to completely painting the picture of what they do and who they are as individuals. Again, Legend Comics and Coffee in Omaha. You guys should probably make a pilgrimage eventually and visit this place. Thanks, guys.
This week on The Couch, we welcome artist Annie Wu. Most of you will know Annie as the artist behind Kate Bishop's adventures in Los Angeles in Matt Fraction and David Aja's Hawkeye. She also co-created the new Batgirl in Batman Beyond with writer Scott Peterson. Annie's a storyboard artist for the Venture Brothers on Adult Swim, and I personally believe she's one of the funniest people on the internet. We are so thrilled to have you hang out with us today.
Thank you for having me. That was a nice intro. That was like a nice little surprise.
Yeah. Well, at least we try to start out professional.
Right, and then let it slowly.
Yeah, Start at a high point. Fall from there. So let's keep it going with your arc on Hawkeye is wrapping up after almost a year of bouncing the story between Clint in New York and Kate in LA. Are there upcoming comic projects you're working on now or heading into 2015 you want to share with us?
Nothing's public yet. I'm still like talking to people because I've been my schedule is so crazy, like things that I thought should have been done by now still aren't done, and I have to get back to a lot of people about potential projects and stuff, and so everything's weird and nebulous right now, and I'm trying to hold off on committing to anything new for a while until I finish up what I have to currently finish up.
Mm-hmm.
Can I ask a bad question? Is the stuff that's not done because you're behind on things or because the projects as a whole are behind or?
It's a little bit of everything. This is probably a really bad thing to admit, but my time management, like I have no concept of time and space and how long it takes to actually do things, and it's really awful. So sometimes I say yes to too many things because I get really excited about a lot of stuff. And so, you know, even if I commit to just my maximum, like right at that edge, if one thing goes over time or whatever, then, you know, that fucks everything else up.
Right.
And so right now I'm trying to like catch up on everything and just do clean slate. But of course that, you know, you can't tell everyone to just like stop emailing me cool things for just a couple months until I get my head clear. So right now it's like, I have one pitch that's been gestating for like 3 years with this one writer. And so that's my top priority after I get everything else done. Like I'm going to finish that up and send it out. And I've got a few variant covers coming up, you know, like one-off things. And I might be doing some guest stuff on some other series, but this is like a super vague answer. I can't even like
specific things. Totally used to the answer of upcoming projects being vague. It's actually just exciting that there are upcoming projects. So
yeah, well, that's cool. Yeah, it's yeah, I've got stuff coming up. I just don't know when or exactly what, but yeah, I'm working on some things.
That, you know, that doesn't sound too bad.
we're
always hoping the one person says, oh yeah, here's all the stuff I can't talk about, but I'm gonna let you guys know about it first. So, you know,
here's the scoop. Yeah, yeah. I signed an NDA, but I will tell you guys.
Yeah,
your secret things.
People sign stuff all the time. Who cares?
For right. Sure.
<That's> fine. Well, so let's talk about some of the stuff that we're familiar with, and particularly with Batgirl and Hawkeye. Like your character designs are very thorough, and I've looked through a bunch of your earlier illustration work and your fan art, and there's so much intentionality behind the costume design, the facial expression, the posture, the poses of your characters, but it doesn't ever feel stilted. Like there's a very free line quality that you have to your style that, like, I personally find really appealing. Can you talk about your approach to giving characters that kind of visual voice? Because you had the chance to do that with Batgirl and Hawkeye recently, and I guess I want to hear about your process with that redesigning, you know, sketch to sort of finished look that brings some of you out in the process as well.
Well, I think that kind of goes back to like in my art school days. I had I went through a Jamie Hewlett thing. You guys are familiar with him? You know, he designed like the gorillas and he did Tank Girl and stuff.
Right.
And so even in his illustrations, he's super detailed with costuming and like fashion, and each character is wearing like a very specific thing that matches their personality, and it's detailed to the point where you wonder who would even notice these things. You know, it's so hyper detailed. Like I can't even explain it. Just look at a gorillas poster or something.
All right, that makes me think of like Jeff Darrow does that too.
Like super detailed.
Yeah, where every panel is like his pages are double sized when he actually draws them out. You know.
Oh my god.
And yeah, you just look at like Shaolin Cowboy, and it's just you're looking and like, why would he draw like little cockroaches on the ground, like a hundred of them or something? But
right.
It's just so the attention to detail is kind of unbelievable.
But even before you get to that point with the panel design, if you have that attention to detail with the character design first, you know, you've built like an entire sort of system around the backstory for a costume change, and that's kind of awesome to put that like headiness into it, because it does translate into the way that the character holds herself or himself and the way they move. Yeah.
I really felt that way with Batgirl, since it was a completely new character and I was, you know, basically designing a costume from scratch. And so with that approach, it was like much more character driven, or like I really got into my head about who this person was and like, oh, she wouldn't wear it something like this because that's not her personality. But you know, she only showed up for 3 issues, so I don't even know how far that was explored. But yeah, so there's like this whole background that never really reveals itself in the story, but it informed my choices when I was designing the costume, if that makes any sense.
Mm-hmm. No, it totally makes sense. I think it has a very theatrical process to it.
Like it's maybe like even more a little, it might be a little, like a little bit more actory than designy. Like if I were this person, what would I wear instead of like what? I mean, trying to find that, trying to split the difference between character driven choices and like what actually looks cool on the page. Like,
right.
That's a balance that I'm always trying to work with.
Was it easier to do that with Kate?
Kate, well, because I didn't have to worry about her, you know, Kate costume. That was like a load off my shoulders. But for her outfits and stuff like that, I'm like, all right, so what I was thinking about was, okay, so she's still Kate Bishop, but she's broke. And she's, you know, I got to do a little like West Coast vibe. Mm-hmm. So what should she wear? And like trying to do all these things and like still make it age appropriate and like fun for, you know, modern times, I guess.
Mm.
Yeah.
It had a very unique feel to it. And I think that it was because so much of the conversation about that book is about the aesthetics.
Mm-hmm.
And so to switch it up and to give a different environment to play in, it needed to change. And I think that was like a character driven change as well that really worked for Kate.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so like, a lot of those choices were, this is very specifically West Coast Kate. Like, she wouldn't wear this if she was still in New York. It's like a very specific choice for this arc. Yeah.
I'm kind of curious, just did Matt Fraction have anything to say about that? Because it seems like the set, I mean, obviously the setting is very much this homage to the Rockford Files. And not that Kate has any kind of specific wardrobe similarities to Jim Rockford, but I was kind of curious if that ever came up in conversation.
Costume specific details in the script.
Sort of, yeah. Like how close? I was kind of curious, like how close to the was he trying to get? You know.
Trying to remember, it was so long ago.
That is the problem, right?
That's how it feels. Matt did specify that big floppy hat.
Oh, cool.
Kate wears, yeah. And so sometimes he'll be like in the final issue, there's one part where she's wearing like this grungy hoodie or whatever, and in the script it just says she basically looks like a Clint cosplayer. Like, this is her Hawkeye outfit. I'm like, yeah, I totally got that. Mm-hmm. And so, but the rest of it was just, more what would Kate Bishop wear on the West Coast? Mm-hmm.
That's fun.
Mm-hmm.
Super fun.
Well, you've talked before about growing up with cartoons and the influence of Bruce Timm's Batman, the animated series, especially. Were print comics equally important to you? Was animation sequential storytelling the ultimate dream after art school?
When I was a kid, I didn't really grow up with Western comics as much.
Hmm.
Like superhero comics, I don't even remember touching those until high school.
Mm-hmm.
And I only got into them, I don't even know if got into them is the correct term. I just like read some of them in high school because people in my classes would be like, hey, you should check this out, and then pass it along to me. But when I was like a kid, it was just mostly cartoons and comics from Hong Kong called Manhwa, which I don't know how to read because I can't read Chinese. I'm terrible. but I would like looking at the pictures and just the drawings and stuff like that.
I mean, is it similar to Japanese manga?
Not really.
Oh, really? Huh.
I'm trying to think. No, I feel like the manga that I read when I was I say read like I knew what was going on in the books, but really I just looked at the pictures.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like the Japanese stuff that I read when I was a kid was much more theatrical, whereas the Hong Kong stuff, maybe it was just the stuff that I was given by my family, was much more cartoony and light. It was almost like a collection of Sunday funnies sort of vibe.
Oh, interesting.
Like it's very jokey and slapsticky.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So that sort of goes hand in hand with more traditional cartoons, or you know, animation.
Maybe more so than Western comics.
Right, like, right.
I never got the vibe that there was something really heavy going on in the stuff I was reading, like, you know, big dramatic storylines. It was just, I could understand what was happening just by looking at the pictures.
Mm-hmm. Oh, okay.
There's one that's called, like, 13 Dots or something. I don't know if that's the correct translation, but I think that's what it is. It was about, like, this young, blonde, super cool chick who was, like, crazy rich and just hung out with her friends. Or that's what it looked like by the pictures. And so I had a collection of those because that's what my family would give me. And
well, who was reading that and passing those down to you?
Oh God, I have a really big family on my mom's side, mm-hmm. and so they all live in Hong Kong. So they would send those to me, like my aunts.
Oh, would you get like would get care packages in the mail, kind of?
Yeah,
care packages of 13 care packages.
Exactly. Because they knew I liked to draw. I've drawn since I was a little kid. So, or when I would visit Hong Kong, those were things that they would give me. That and like Sailor Moon, Art of Sailor Moon type books.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Which, again, I couldn't understand. But I'm like, wow, look at these drawings and costume designs. Mm-hmm. So amazing.
Well, that is, I mean, that for so much of people, like that's the accessibility of comics is being able to follow the story through the art and then mm-hmm. learning to read almost from that.
Yeah. So I never got that far with Chinese, but
well, there's still time.
Yeah. Is there though?
I feel it like sounds like you have so is. Much free time on your hands.
Yeah, and I'm already.
Why don't you teach yourself Chinese like in the process?
I feel like I've reached that age where it's like my brain can no longer absorb language.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so
I think I'm done.
But were your parents first generation here?
First generation means that they were born here or they moved here?
That's a good question. I was thinking moved here.
Moved here. Yes, they moved here. And so I guess I was the first generation that was born here. Yeah. My dad's from China. My mom's from Hong Kong.
I'm always just kind of curious about that when I'm assuming maybe, I hope it's the right term, but like first generation families and assimilation, you know, of their children and different families seem to go about it differently. And I don't know if it's cultural or just by family, but, you know, how much culturally, you know, I'm kind of curious in terms of art too, like how much of Chinese culture was part of your growing up?
They never really like forced it down my throat or anything.
Sure, but like, did they speak Chinese in the house or?
Yeah, totally. We spoke Chinese in the house. But not because like we have to maintain this.
Uh-huh.
It was just something that happened. Like my younger sister, she's 4 years younger than me. She mostly speaks English to my parents.
Hmm.
And, I once described it as, like Han Solo and Chewbacca where, you know, they're both speaking their own languages, but they totally understand each other.
Right.
And it's perfectly fine. So that's kind of like their deal, but I really make an effort to, speak Chinese when I'm with my Chinese family members, because when else am I going to be able to, you know, maintain that?
Mm-hmm.
And so, yeah, I guess that's about it. I mean, we would watch Chinese TV at home and they tried teaching me how to write Chinese and like read it. And then they gave up after I just couldn't pick it up.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah,
I always just find that fascinating especially for creative people, because
mm-hmm.
I mean, our upbringings influence our lives going forward so much. And
sure.
In terms of visual arts too, you know, growing up with immigrant parents and from another culture, I'm just, do you ever notice that in your own creative work? Like taking any elements of that upbringing?
Sometimes there are like, stories that I would read when I was a kid, which, I don't know how to explain it. Just kind of that sort of epic nature to some of those stories like really appeal to me. So uh-huh. I'm like, oh, I should write something like that. Like these old stories that I would. You guys have heard of the Monkey King, you know, Journey to the West.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
All that kind of stuff. Yeah. So I'm still kind of attracted to that sort of storytelling.
Mm.
I don't know if it's more of a nostalgia thing or whatever, but yeah, sometimes these things from my childhood still.
Well, I also found in like for me in art school, it was very Western focused. Like the history of art was mm-hmm. so predominantly presented from the Western perspective. And so I think that if you have access to other influences because mm-hmm. of your family, like, that's not necessarily something that you, you know, you pull out this checklist of like, here are all of my influences in art. And, you know, right. I have a very regimented approach to it, but it right. could be very organic the way that you've pooled experience and
yeah.
education together.
I actually wonder if it affects more of my approach to what I could, like, what inspires me rather than specific inspiration, if that makes any sense. Because, like,
totally.
When people ask me, you know, what inspires you, I'd never really thought about it until then, because it's hard to categorize. There's so many different things. Like, it's so natural for me to just pull inspiration from things that are even outside of comics, like, mm-hmm. just from, you know, different cultures and whatever. But, yeah, so categorizing yeah. it is unnatural to me.
Sure, yeah.
Yeah, agreed. Agreed. Well, so I want to talk more about cartoons, especially mm-hmm. the Venture Brothers, because, like, I fucking love that show.
I love
but
that
I
show,
don't...
too.
I don't have, like, a really great question about it. Like, I've been thinking about this, and I really kind of just want to hear about what you do on the show, and, like, how do you not just laugh constantly as you're working on it? But I guess for the sake of conversation, a little bit about, like, storyboarding for animation and how that might inform your own thumbnailing for, like, comics storytelling.
Sure. So I worked on season 5, and I did character and prop color design. Mm-hmm. And then when season 6 started, which is the one that we're working on now, I moved into the storyboard department doing storyboard revision. And so that means I get to do, like, a lot of, like, cleaning up other people's boards, but that means I get to, like, do all the facial expressions and, like,
awesome.
Adding acting and stuff, which I love. but I was told maybe later in the season I might actually get to do my own storyboards. But anyway, it does actually inform some of my comic work, because you have to be really conscious of clarity and framing things in an interesting way without losing just, like, the readability of it.
Okay.
Yeah, so I feel like I know for a fact I wouldn't have gotten into the storyboard department if I didn't already have comic experience. Like, if the creator hadn't already seen my comics, I would not be working in the storyboard department. And I feel like my comic work wouldn't be as strong if I didn't have this storyboard stuff going on, like, pushing me to,
because sure.
it's not just, like, panel by panel. You have to, like, sit there all day and, like, break down a sequence. And it's like, I don't want to call it practice, because it's a job that I actually have to do. But I feel like my work, I do have to draw faster and, like, more, be a little bit more clear. And that does inform my comic work as well.
Do you do that from home?
No, I have to go into the studio.
Okay.
The Venture Brothers job is, like, my first job where I've had to actually go into a studio or,
okay.
like, go someplace, like, put on clothes, look like a normal human being, and, like, brush my teeth in the morning and, like, go to a place and work with other people. So it's like a weekday job.
How is that, though? Like, as an artist, as somebody who's worked both independently and as a collaborator, like, you're part mm-hmm. of a much bigger system now. Was that a weird
yeah.
adjustment?
It was. 'Cause let me see. Especially when I was doing character and prop color last season, I was pretty much the last step in the process before they shipped off all the stuff to Korea to be animated into the actual show. So if I was slow, I held up the entire, like, nothing could ship from the characters, prop design. Yeah. So
that's a lot of fucking pressure.
It was a lot of late nights. It was just like, I'm trying to color as fast as I can.
Oh, God.
I mean, it was all, like, paint bucketing, but I would have to, like, make it look nice. And yeah, so that was a little stressful. But now I'm, like, a little further ahead in the process. Like, I do the storyboards, and then what's the next step? Oh, they have to do, like, direction. So there's, like, a few more steps behind me, so it's like it feels a little bit different. But
are you part of a team? So like, there's more than one person doing the revisions?
There's one other person doing revisions, and then there's a bigger storyboard team that does their thing and then passes it on to us. So yeah, there is a process, but then now that I'm thinking about it, when I do comics, I have to pass it on to, you know, a colorist and a letterer and, you know, everybody and all the editors and stuff afterwards too. So I don't know. It's different. It depends on where you are in the process, in the machine, if you will.
Right.
I have a weird question just that I thought of when we were talking about this. So this is kind of the first job you have to go into an office for, you know, and the rest. And we've talked so much to creators about the kind of life of isolation, you know, when you're kind of just sitting at a desk doing comics all day, it can get kind of lonely. But, well, that's what I'm curious about. Like, so many of the people we talk to are pretty heavily entrenched in social media. But, I mean, even before we started, you said you deleted your Facebook a while ago. And this is a weird question to ask because it probably means you're healthier than most people, but like, what do you do for human interaction when you're not having to go into that office?
I'm like a super introvert. Like I'm not one of those people that just says they're introverted and that just means they're kind of quiet at parties. It's like, I avoid parties. I have an exit strategy when I have to go to parties. I mean, I have friends. I'm not like a crazy person, but I'm one of those people that,
You said that pretty,
defensively. Yeah. I know no one mentioned it, but I just want to say I have
lots of friends. None of them are around right now, and I don't have to give you their name, but they're around.
Oh, one just came in, and then I do a different voice. Sure. I can be social, but I do recharge when I'm by myself. Like I need my alone time. I know some other people, they recharge when they have a lot of people around them, and it's just like a different, you just have to know which one you are. And I'm very aware that I'm like an introverted person. The less that I have to worry about being social, you know, the better. In terms of hanging out and stuff, I mean, with Twitter, I've made so many like real life friends. You know, we hang out in New York, or even people that don't live in this country or this state, when they do visit, you know, because of conventions or tours or whatever.
So is Twitter your primary kind of social network?
Social media? Yeah. I guess so. Since, I mean, even when I had Facebook, it wasn't for professional. It was mostly like, you know, people from high school that I never talked to, that felt obligated to add because they requested or whatnot. So it's mostly just Twitter now, or Tumblr too, I guess. Okay. But
So is the professional interaction that happens from work sort of a different, like you slide into a different mindset? Because it's a little bit obligatory, and it's definitely, like, it has a different end goal than being social. Like, you have to go and do that.
At the studio?
Right.
Oh, I mean, it's definitely, like, a job, but I like everybody there. They're great. And we talk to each other between seasons.
But you can also just sort of focus on the work in a way that...
Yeah. It's also nice because I'm not actually an animator by... trade. I mean, in the sense that this is my thing. Because a lot of the people there, they work studio jobs basically their entire careers. Like they are a background designer. That is what they do. Whereas I'm like kind of all over the place. And so I don't have to worry about what I'm going to be doing at the studio after this season. So it's kind of like a little bit less pressure on me.
Sure.
If that makes any sense. That's pretty nice. I can just focus on being friendly with the people and doing my work, and it's really nice.
That's good.
Well, let's talk about comics then for a second.
Sure.
So going back to Hawkeye, and I think this is correct, but that Matt Fraction found your work online, which led you to doing the romance covers in the Valentine's Day issue. And that's what kind of led to handling Kate's storyline?
I don't know the exact story, but
that's what
friends.
I wrote into Wikipedia, so it's got to be true.
Oh, no. Wikipedia might be wrong. We had been Twitter friendly for a while. I don't know how we found each other, but, you know, mm-hmm. as you do, sure. I guess, if you work in comics. So we were Twitter friendly. And then one day he asked me if I wanted to do, like, he sent me a DM if I wanted to do some pages in an upcoming book. And so when it was those romance covers, I was like, yeah, totally, sure. And so I did that. And then when the Kate arc came around, I'm not totally sure about this, but I think they went back into that team of guest artists that had already done stuff for the book. Mm-hmm. And I was on that list. And so they asked me after someone else dropped out, I think. Mm. Not totally sure. But I was available and I was interested. And so I was like, yeah, I'm down to do that.
So to kind of go back to that whole social media talk, like, the professional and the friendly kind of overlapping, especially seems like in comics where it's mm-hmm. it's a small community and the friends you make mm-hmm. probably lead to the work that comes up too. Mm-hmm. Like, is that an important part of your professional career at this point? Like, having those friend connections, like all
yeah,
the stuff
totally.
That kind of gets thrown your way.
Yeah. Even if I don't end up working with, if I don't have the opportunity to work with like friends, they are supportive enough to like, or everyone's just really cool about sharing each other's work. You know, mm-hmm. like when you see something that excites you, you would share it. And then hopefully that leads to someone else who can collaborate with you or like keep you in mind for future projects. And yeah, I feel like it's definitely important. Like when I was in art school, I graduated in 2010. And we had like a business class for illustrators mm. where we would be taught what the typical way to get jobs is.
Mm-hmm.
And it had a lot to do with like printing postcards and getting the names and addresses for all these companies and like editors and art directors and like.
And this was 2010, you know, not 1990.
This is not 1990 because. I feel like the whole marketing yourself online thing is still actually pretty new if you look at, mm-hmm. you know, the big picture. And people still, and everyone gets jobs in such weird, unconventional ways. There's no direct path. Whereas, mm-hmm. you know, maybe a couple decades ago, you really did have to print out your portfolio super nice and, like, be somewhere physically to either meet someone or drop something off.
Yeah.
And if you weren't in New York or, you know, LA or Chicago where publishing houses were or, you know, you might not be able to get work. Whereas now, if you're on Twitter and like someone thinks that your work is cool or just thinks you're interesting and you have interesting ideas, that can lead to a collaboration. You don't even have to be in the same country or
but it's basically impossible to it's impossible to teach. You can't teach a class in. Make friends with writers online. Get
yeah,
into
exactly,
their good
like,
graces.
Exactly. Like even people have differing opinions on where you should post your work. Like I was telling someone, like, what's the point of DeviantArt? Because DeviantArt was a big thing for people my age,
mm-hmm.
Like through maybe middle school and high school. And so I was like, yeah, of course I left it because who's there but people that do fan art and like no one professionals that no one who can give you a job is on there. And then my friend was like, no, I've gotten work through DeviantArt because there are people that grew up doing fan art on there now are professional people and can, you know, like recruit people for their projects. So yeah, you can totally get work on DeviantArt. And that blew my mind.
Mm.
So there really is no conventional path anymore. And it's really hard to teach. And so when people ask me for advice, I'm like, I don't know. Like, I am pretty sure, for example, Matt Fraction and I only we're Twitter friendly with each other because we joked around a lot.
Mm-hmm.
Like, how do you tell people to do that? Like,
be really Twitter funny. You take it. So like,
Twitter funny,
right? There should be a class on how to be Twitter funny.
Sure. And like my job on Venture Brothers was only because I did fan art and I posted it online and the creator saw it and then suggested me to his color department to take a test. So like, how do you like, apart from make stuff you like and then put it out there. Like, what do you tell people?
No, that's it right there.
Make stuff you like and put it out there. I guess so, but where? And then they want to know, where do I put it?
On the internet.
Yeah, sure. Anywhere on the internet.
Well, it is interesting because we live now in a generation of creative people who, for the most part, find each other through social media, which means that in addition to having the skills of being, you know, a good artist or a good writer or whatever it is, you have to be good at online interaction.
Yeah.
Which is just interesting.
What do you even tell
people? Right.
Yeah.
Well, it's like, also because talking, that's why I kind of was asking about the social media question of, you know, a lot of introverted people, it runs the gamut, but you have people with maybe non-traditionally social personalities. And
that's very kind. That's very kind.
Well, myself included.
Right. You said it, not me.
Sure. But having that be a primary way of finding, you know, finding each other is just very fascinating in terms of like the history now of comics.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I feel like sometimes I wonder if I'd be able to get any work if we didn't live in such a digital age, if that doesn't sound too like old timey to say, but I keep trying to picture myself going in to speak to an art director, flipping through a big portfolio of my artwork, just like, I can't picture it. Like, I would never get hired. I would just be like crying or sweating in front of them, and then I would just not get any work. Whereas, you know, online, I can pretend I'm not crying and sweating when I'm emailing editors.
I mean, maybe in a way it's always kind of been like that. Like, I think of somebody like Steve Ditko, who notoriously is a recluse, you know, but is one of the biggest names in you know, traditional superhero comics, but you know, can't talk to people, has a social phobia, refuses to be interviewed or photographed, and would just lock himself in his office. I think that's an extreme case, but yeah, I guess if you kind of look at the history of comics in a lot of creative industries, maybe it is somewhat similar. It's just that technology makes it easier for those of us who find looking people in the eye and shaking hands difficult.
Those of us. That was nice.
Sure.
Those of us.
I can be very articulate when I don't have to actually be face to face with someone.
This is actually a really good segue for my next question, because I find this part of you really fascinating, Annie, because you do improv. Yeah.
Oh, so yeah. Right.
How do you, like, how does that work? I have this theory about artists being like comfortable as actors with their bodies. And I think that you sort of touched on that earlier in terms of projecting your expression with, you know, how Batgirl or how Hawkeye would be presented, and a little bit even with the storyboarding and the revisions that you're doing. It sounds like they go hand in hand for you. Like, how does that reconcile with your being an extreme introvert?
I wonder that all the time. Because people have asked me that before, because people know that I'm kind of quiet and real. I don't even know if I'm quiet. I don't know. I'm all over the place. But when they hear that I do improv, they can't really picture it. And then when they see it, it still doesn't quite make sense. But I don't know. I've always been a big comedy nerd. And so when I did it, it just felt correct and fun.
That's awesome.
Yeah, it's great. And
Are you still doing it? Sorry.
Yeah, I actually just got back. I ran back from practice just before this interview.
Awesome.
I have like a regular team and like people that I like to play with. It's more of, you know, seeking people that you like collaborating with and doing weird things together.
Is that do you do stuff at the UCB in New York?
UCB is I'm not like officially associated with them. Mm-hmm. Like, I don't perform on a team that was created by the theater, but that's where my friends and I met. And that's kind of like what I personally consider my home theater, because that's where I trained and whatnot. But yeah, this kind of goes back to that whole ambiguous inspirations thing. Like, it all kind of melds together. Like, all the things that I like doing or watching, they all kind of inform each other. Mm-hmm. Like, I feel like my my comic book work and my animation work actually does inform my improv the way that improv informs my artwork, because when you do improv, you have to know who you're playing, even if that information doesn't actually come out of your mouth or doesn't actually become relevant in the scene. It's in your head, and so it informs the way that you carry yourself and the way that you talk. And if someone asks you a question about your personal philosophy as that character, you have to be able to answer that in that voice, you know. Mm-hmm. And like, even if that philosophy doesn't gel with your real life one, like, you should be able to defend your actions, you know. And so that informs when I come up with stories, and when I do storyboard for Venture, like, I try to keep in mind, like, everything that I know about the show, and, like, would this character stand this way, or, like, would they interact with this other character in this way? The same way, you know, it informs improv.
Has it always been improv? Did you ever try stand-up?
I never tried. I thought about stand-up, and I'm, like, too in my head to actually do it.
Well, it's a very different type of comedy, right?
Yeah, totally, because you have to... with stand-up, you have to, like, perfect. You have to, like, labor over this one very specific... You're, like, crafting something very specific, like, these perfect 5 minutes, mm-hmm. and then you have to keep testing it and then, like, chiseling it down until it's brief and perfect, whereas improv is more like a muscle that you have to exercise. Like, you have to know how to do it. I don't know how to explain it. It's like you have to train yourself to react in realistic ways, and like, it's more like training than craft, if that makes any sense.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, it's also collaborative. Objects.
Yeah, exactly. You have to work as part of a group, or like, there's also like the element of finding people that you like playing with, mm-hmm. which is kind of interesting.
Well, it's very much like comics, I guess, right?
Yes, exactly. The closest I ever did to stand-up was I emceed my friend's burlesque show a few years ago. Like, I did that twice, and that's the closest I ever did to stand-up. And even then, I was like playing a character. Right. So, yeah, I don't know if I'm like comfortable enough talking about myself to do actual stand-up.
Maybe that's the next challenge, though, is getting past the uncomfortable, because there, with improv, you can almost, you're just from viewing it, it seems that there is a safety in the group, and that you know, you can support and cover each other, where where stand up is, you're up there on the stage by yourself.
That's you bearing your soul, if no one laughs, that's them judging you directly.
Right.
Yeah. You can share the blame in improv.
Yeah. Yeah, I was having an off night, whereas, like, stand-up, it's, oh, I worked really hard on this, and they still didn't like it. Mm. I'm not ready for that. I don't know if I ever will be.
Well, we usually wrap up with suggestions and recommendations. Also, you're supposed to give us just a piece of advice that will change people's lives. So,
No pressure.
So, you know, comics, movies, shows, and then, you know, a life philosophy that will keep people going through till the end of time.
One, two, three, go.
Okay, so I'm ready for the first part, because I've made a tiny list.
Let's do this as improv. Oh, okay. I need one life philosophy. Improv? Yeah, one life philosophy. One life altering motto.
Oh my gosh. I need a location.
Uh-huh. Shangri-La.
That classic suggestion. books. All right, I don't have a lot of time to like read comics while I'm working on comics, but I did check out the first few issues of Southern Bastards, and I dug that.
Yeah.
I'm starting Cowl.
Mm-hmm.
From Image. That looks pretty interesting. Did you also say like TV and movies and stuff like that? Because that's what I have. That's what I have on in the background, like, all the time while I'm working. I'm really into Broad City and Rick and Morty lately, because they're like new things from this year. Oh, and Key and Peele.
Uh-huh.
Have you guys heard?
Everybody's talking about Key and Peele.
I like Key and Peele. They're funny.
Mm-hmm.
I don't have anything more descriptive than that, other than, oh yeah, they make me laugh. Have you guys heard of Utopia from Channel 4? It's like a British show. It's like a conspiracy type show that's run for 2 series so far. It's like 6 episodes each, or maybe 8. Hmm. But it's like really pretty. It's like all candy colored, but it's really brutal in its subject matter. Like, people get shot and like beat up, but it's shot in this like really saturated, I don't know how to explain it. Just check it out. It's like visually very nice. It's like candy, but the subject matter is horrible. And I've also been watching a lot of old musicals, which I think everybody should.
Nice.
Yeah, old musicals?
Yeah.
Sure. Go for it.
Sure.
Absolutely. I mean, Aaron hates theater and everything that brings joy to me in my life.
You hate theater?
Yeah. I don't hate theater. I'm not the biggest fan of musical theater.
You hate everything.
That's like saying books. No, that's like a whole genre of things.
Look, a man has to have some principles and things he stands by.
Oh boy,
we got to draw some lines in the sand.
You're limiting yourself, my friend.
Yeah. Right. Thank
you. Check out some musicals.
I've seen
ridiculous.
Oklahoma. I like The Music Man.
Oh my God.
Oh boy. Okay.
What's your favorite musical, Annie?
My favorite musical?
Or top three, if that's easy.
No, that's worse. I don't know.
I've seen Cats.
It changes from Cats.
I've seen Cats.
I'm all about Cats, you guys. Uh-huh. Did you just name all the musical that you know? Like Oklahoma.
Music Man, and Cats. Cats. I think I think that about covers it.
Have you ever seen Falsettos?
No.
I know you haven't, Aaron. Annie, have you seen Falsettos?
No. No, I haven't. What's that one?
It's rarely produced as like a full, well, I guess now more it is. It's 3 1 acts in trousers, March of the Falsettos and Falsetto Land. And it's perfect. I mean, it's my favorite musical, like, ever.
Is it a strictly stage thing, or has there ever been like an adaptation in TV or movie?
I don't think it's ever been filmed. It's William Finn and James Lapine. So it is pretty well respected. It just isn't performed very often. I mean, I've heard people say that it's dated. It deals with like a gay couple and in the early 80s, and then the response in the mid 80s, one of them gets sick, and it sort of touches on that transition. But God, the music is fucking fantastic. And there's a bar mitzvah in the middle of it, because why not? And
well, sold.
Right? But,
yeah. Actually, I wrote down The Wicker Man. Have you guys ever seen The Wicker Man, like the old one?
Just the great one with Nick Cage.
No, of course the Nick Cage one. No, the old one is like borderline musical. There's like,
what? No way.
Yeah, it's like a bunch of like weird ass folk songs, and like it's really bizarre. But I've always like, I watched it for the first time earlier this year, and I was like, this would be the best stage musical. It would be so amazing. And I looked it up, and I was like, no one's done it as a stage musical before, except for like one random Scottish town. This should be like on Broadway.
Oh, nice.
Wicker Man would be so amazing. I don't know who I need to talk to, like president of Broadway or like king of Broadway. But, oh man. Yeah.
I think that's Frank Sinatra. So maybe.
Frank Sinatra?
Damn it.
I'm going to pick up my red phone to Sinatra. But yeah, watch the old Wicker Man.
Okay.
Ridiculous.
Awesome.
Ridiculous.
And now the moment we've all been waiting for.
Oh, fuck. Give me an example.
Your life advice earlier, and Aaron's just being a dick. You said, pick something that you love and just do it. And that's like, that's a thing right there. That's your life advice.
Yeah. Oh man, yeah, you guys, especially like now with the internet, it's like you don't have to conform to what the popular thing is now. Just whatever excites you, like do a really good job at it and like put it online. And then people who also like it, who have the power to like make things happen, you guys will find each other.
Right.
You don't have to worry about like conforming to what you think is the popular thing. Like go be a weirdo. Go do your own thing. And then you'll find your tribe.
Because the internet loves everybody.
The internet doesn't have, it doesn't have the ability to discriminate. Go be a weirdo.
I like that.
They're
that
bigger weirdos than you. Yeah.
Awesome.
Perfect.
That's the weirdest, like, dumbest fortune cookie you could ever get. It's just a rambling.
It's a really long fortune cookie.
It's a big fortune cookie that barely makes any sense. Go be this cookie just told me to be a weirdo. All right.
Thank you again to Annie Wu for joining us on the couch this weekend. Thanks to all of you for listening to another episode of Comics Therapy. Don't forget to pre-order your comics at your local shop and subscribe to them digitally. Show notes and other details are on our site, as always, comicstherapy.com. We will see you next week. Secret Agent Man. Secret Agent Man. A secret agent.